Okay.
That's the one that I call.
It's a pretty straightforward class. It may last less than an hour, although I always say that, and then I go about an hour and a half. So we'll see actually what happens. We went through a lot of the pro stuff, just to sort of recap what we've done. We talked about the Satan. That took us through the whole Satan story. We spoke about the disasters that befell him. We went through that whole process of the series of disasters that befell him. We haven't discussed his wife too much, although we mentioned a little bit about it. The only characters that we really haven't discussed in the first two chapters, and after we're done with the first two chapters, then essentially we're on to the poetry section. So I'm hoping next week to actually be on the poetry, and that's where it gets a little bit weird. But we'll see what kind of pace we have. But we're, by and large, even though we did a piecemeal, we're pretty much finished with the first two chapters of the Book of Job. The last characters that are in the story that I think bear examining are the kids. Because the kids' part of the story seems to be not entirely necessary. Because I need to know he has kids, because the kids get destroyed. So that I need to know he has kids. But there's this whole strange story about the kids, which I certainly, when I was reading it at a much younger and a little bit less knowledgeable, I think about the, not that I'm all that knowledgeable now, but certainly less knowledgeable than I am now, the whole story struck me as very strange for a biblical story. Let's just read through it. And that would be chapter 1, verse 4. V'halchu v'anav. This is Eov, chapter 1, verse 4. We're just going to read two sentences. V'halchu v'anav, his children used to go, v'asu mishteh, beit ish yomo. Each person, a single day, which means he had seven kids, so each kid would make a party on one day of the week. It would be a Sunday party, a Monday party, a Tuesday party. I suppose as a 20th century reader, 21st century reader, the whole thing struck me as kind of excess. Maybe I'm looking at it through Karl Marx's eyes. I'm not sure that's the right eyes to look it through, but it seems to be an exceeding amount of excess. And that's the first thing that started that when I was reading it, I certainly smelled a rat. By the way, don't concern yourself about the tense. V'halchu v'anav is not exactly past tense. What it is, it's called a habitual tense in poetry. What that means is, this is the way it used to be, this is the way it is. It uses the past tense to show you that this is the way it's always been, and this is the way it continues to be. No, it's not v'halchu, it's standard past tense. This is v'halchu, it's a standard copy of the levav, meaning viz and halchu. If you're curious, if you haven't Rashi, I can read to you what Rashi says about this tense. It's pretty well known in poetry. It doesn't show up much outside of poetic books, where it says they called, v'shalchu v'karu. They called and they sent messengers and they called, so they're three sisters. So just to read you Rashi, it's an interesting grammatical Rashi. V'shalchu v'karu, they called, past tense, and they sent, past tense. Kimo, Rashi says, v'shalchim v'korim. It's a participle. It means they would call, they call and they send. Shahayu osim kain tamid. That's the way they would always do things. So essentially it's called the habitual tense. It's present tense, but it uses the past tense to sort of establish a long-standing ritual. But you shouldn't necessarily read this as past tense. It doesn't happen much out of biblical books, but you should always keep in mind. There are a few things like that. You always have to be careful when people always have problems with these things, such as when Abraham manages to try to sacrifice Yitzchak, and Hashem comes down and he says, Ataya dati. So people always have problems with that. Now, I knew. So people always try to darshan that out. But the truth is, yadati is used not really for past tense, it's used for present tense in that case. Yadati, ahavti, zakanti, vani zakanti. Doesn't mean I got old in the past, it means I have become old and now I'm old. It has a sense of now it's happening, although if I wanted to, I could establish it as a habitual or as an existing idea. So it uses past tense, but essentially it's speaking in the present. And there are very few words that are like that. Ahavti, zakanti, yadati. So those words you have to watch out for. They're not quite as past tense as one would think. And here, in this case, you really have a whole tense in poetry, which is trying to establish the present through what's called the habitual. V'halchu banav asu mishteh bein beit ish yomo. Everybody had a day. V'shalchu v'karu, and they sent and they called. L'shloshet achiyotehem, so they're three sisters, l'chol v'lishtotenem, come and drink and party with them. V'yihi kihi kifu yimei amishtah, when the day of the party was circled, which means what all the parshim say, what that means when they got back around to Sunday, either Sunday or Shabbat, maybe Shabbat, maybe Sunday. Vayishlach Iyov, vayikadishen. Very strange language. So Iyov would send. Wasn't clear what Iyov is sending. Vayishlach Iyov, vayikadishen, and he would make them holy, which is the literal translation. Although obviously it doesn't really fit. Vehishkim baboker, and then he would get up in the morning. So mistama, he was doing this act of kedusha and of shlichut on Shabbat itself, right? You'd start on Sunday. The pagans also started their week on Sunday back then, before the Christians and the Muslims decided they needed a new Sabbath. So before that, everybody, I think, was pretty square on the idea that the Sabbath was the Sabbath. And so apparently he was doing this on Saturday, after the day of the last, after the last party. And then he would wake up in the morning, v'shkim baboker v'ala alot, he would raise burnt sacrifices, mispar kulam, according to the number of all of them. It's a little difficult to say what that means. All of the kids, all of the days. It's not clear whether it's 10 or 7 here. Ki amar Iyov, because Iyov would say, habitually, what he would say, ulai chat'u vanai, maybe my sons have sinned, uverchu Elohim bilibam, bilvavam, and they curse God in their hearts. Berchu in this case is to curse. Kacha yase Iyov kol hayamim. And that's what Iyov would do all of the day, which means all the time. That's what he would do on a regular basis. As a modern reader, I'm thinking, that's a weird story. What do I need to know that for? I mean, does that... It adds a little bit about the piousness of Iyov, that he was worried about other people's sins. Okay, I'll buy that. But since the kids get it later... and they get it in most, you know, vociferous, very terrible ways. The question is, were they committing sins? That's a question. And of course, to a modern reader, something spicy, what's the whole thing with the girls coming to the party? It's a very strange thing. How often do we really talk about girls in Tanakh? How often do they really come up? Occasionally you have a woman in the lineage charts. Occasionally you have a woman like Bat Anah or Mei Zahav when they come up, and then there's a whole midrashic story. What's that?
Rachab.
Right, so Rachab, so no, that's exactly right. That's right. When women come into play, there's always something fishy going on. And not entirely. I mean, there's Sarah and there's Rivka. Of course, Rivka is coming to conflict. You have certainly stories, especially about the Imahot. And there's Devorah because she can't escape it. She was the woman. But really, where do you get to... She was the woman with a capital C and a capital W. But
the scene here of who everybody is.
I agree with that. And I agree we need to know that he's got... kids, and he's got sons, and he's got daughters, because we need to know that they're wiped out. But what does it really add, all of the detail? And even if I wanted to say that they were partying, and that they were maybe committing sins in their hearts, which is what he's saying, what do I need the girls there for? He doesn't even accuse the girls of it. He says, ulai chat'u vanai. Vanai is specifically my sons. It really does not mean my sons and my daughters. Vanai. It doesn't say vanai uvanotai. He specifically says,
no. We often... use it that way.
Probably
like children.
We do. Usually when it's b'neichem, so the Chazal correctly darshan out b'neichem v'lo b'noteichem. And you should know that in most cases in Devarim, when it's talking about man or woman, it says ish o isha ki ya'alem mal hazeh, man or a woman. I'm not saying it's impossible that vanai here means boys. It's not impossible. But since the pasuk went out of its way to separate the boys from the girls, it seems to me that it could have easily have said vanai uvnotai. I'm not saying that that's absolutely necessary, but it does strike me that he's not really that interested in the boys, because the girls' sin is never really, not really a focus. I mean, I suppose. So why bring them up? So my 20th first century MTV mind, I'm thinking, I don't know, I'm looking like an MTV, one of those beach party things, right? I don't know if that's what you had in mind. I sense that the fact they invited the girls, who knows what's going on at this party? I don't know, is that what you wanted to pop in?
The whole word, like how she seems strange. I mean, if they just invited them to a party, it's fine. The whole idea of the father being so worried and so on makes you come to think that there's something fishy going on.
It certainly has that air of fishiness. It's very curious.
Could you say that the reason, this might have been you picked up on that, it's been the show of saying this, but yeah. I just want to show that they're normal people, they're not just like and his great tzaddikim, and that don't think that it's Eel and his children for being tested. It's just Eel being tested.
Why? Because the test wouldn't be useful for the kids also. It's true, although there, and I'm not disagreeing with that, although there would be nicer if it would have said, Ulai chat'u b'vanai. What Eov seems to be saying that the only possibility of sin that he can even imagine for his kids is a sin, is hir hur shabalev. That is, I'm not worried that my kids ate the wrong kind of foods, the Eivar Minachai, because they're not Jewish. I'm not worried that they did something that was sexually inappropriate. I'm worried that maybe in their hearts they said, oh, I can't believe the taste of this wine. It really stinks. Gosh darn it. You know, that kind of thing. I'm not exactly sure what they were thinking in their party, but it's some kind of blasphemy against God for whatever situation they're in, but never something that actually comes to fruition. That Eov doesn't seem to be raising it as a possibility that his kids may actually be committing physical sins. And again, if that's true, and I'm not saying, and why do I think you're right? Because if it's true that there were no physical sins, what do I need the girls there for? I just don't understand where the girls come into play unless I specifically have a lascivious type of sin. And if I don't have a lascivious type of sin, then why is Eov only concerning about sins of the heart? Sins of the heart.
Maybe it's also, he could be talking about a type of relationship, a type of behavior, because though it's not a outright sin, but it's, you know, something that goes against the nature of something of holiness.
Right. So I think what the issue here is that we're looking at the psukim and we're trying to smell a rat. And that was my sense also reading it. Something stinks here. Something is out of place. Something is unusual. And since we're all talking about sin and punishment, I smell something weird going on. And that's certainly, as I said before, that was always my reading of it. So I look in Mefarshim, and I look for some parish to say something about it, and nobody does. I got Rashi. Rashi's here on Pasuk Dalet. Rashi says, V'alchu v'ana v'asu m'shtei b'ish yomo, b'vei kol achad achav yomo. So he says, everyone a separate day. So this doesn't mention the girls thing at all. It doesn't mention them even a little bit. I look at Eben Ezra. Eben Ezra's got nothing on the girls. I mean, if there was a suspicion of sin with the girls, so tell us about it. And yet nobody mentions anything about the
girls'
kids.
Sisters?
They're sisters, yeah.
They're the sisters of the seven brothers.
Otherwise it wouldn't be a problem.
Well, I don't think we're worried about... what are you thinking? I don't think we're worried about incest. We're just worried about the weirdness of a mixed party in biblical times. It seems a little strange. I don't think I'm looking at the big sin. I'm just smell kind of a little sin. But something bigger than Eo, who's only worried about... is that what you were hinting at, the fact that they were specifically sisters?
Well, yeah, I wanted to know, were they siblings, or were they, when you say, the girls...
Specifically sisters. Yeah. And the question is, what about their families? Do they have families? We're left a little bit in the dark as far as
they
the whole...
They
have their own house. We don't know if they have kids. What? Yeah, that's correct. Exactly right. It seems very make-merry. It's very paganistic, right? Where does it say? To eat and to drink with them. So is this just a pleasant, it's like a Thanksgiving where I, of course, can invite my sister, because if I don't, you'll never hear the end of it, you know, from the whole family politics thing? Or is there something else going on? The only reason why I might not think it's the first one is because the Bible usually doesn't deal with, like, it's a family issue. I mean, what do I need to know that, yes, they were nice enough to invite their, unless it's telling us that a special mitzvah, that they were so good, they never threw a Thanksgiving party on a daily basis. And apparently the girls are partying every day. They're partying every day. So again, there's this sense of excess, there's this sense of the men and the women, and yet, I don't know what to say, and all the Mefarshim are silent about it.
Well, I have a question here that's off of that. But it got a shame. What does
that
mean?
Oh, excellent.
How did we... make them holy or
beautiful.
Whatever.
What exactly does Vayikad Hashem mean? Correct, because if Vayikad Hashem is in reaction to a potential sin, then how can we understand the best way to gauge the level of the sin is to gauge the level of steps that were necessary for Eo to take. So Vayikad Hashem is definitely a word that I'm going to get to shortly as part of the whole panoply.
Okay.
I just want to, I know that Anne had an issue, so I want to...
First of all, it's not clear that the sisters come every day, because they have to send for them each time.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's not a given that the sisters are coming.
Okay, that's not the way I saw it, but okay. Also, keep in mind that all of his kids are dead when the party falls apart. You know, when the house actually comes tumbling down,
yeah.
The brothers and the sisters are all gone. So they were certainly there on that one very bad day.
But maybe this is mentioned in order to explain why they were there. One, why they were all together, because they used to get together to eat and drink. Maybe they just
together. It could be to make sure that we knew why the girls were wiped out also, and
right.
that it would sort of support
they were all
the story.
Wiped out in one fell
swoop. Yeah, it's true. I don't deny that. Yeah, it's true. It seems to be more of the sinning section than the all the bad things happening later on. But it's true. It may just be a necessary setup to know that the girls died also, because otherwise you could always say, well, why should he be so sad? At least he's got three daughters left. That's a very viable answer, and I certainly didn't think of that before you mentioned it. And it is viable. However, I'm not the only one who smells a rat. I'm sorry.
Another possibility is, like, what else if they're getting together? What else are they getting together and to do? Are they playing softball together?
Well, apparently just to eat and drink. You mean you see some lasciviousness? I don't...
No, just to get together.
Yeah, again, it's
that
very mundanity which the Torah doesn't usually delve into. The Torah is there to teach us lessons, moral lessons, or, if necessary, to set up a story about a future moral lesson. Just to tell us about the life and times of Eov's kids, it strikes me as a little too mundane, something I wouldn't expect. So if you take a look on the sheets at the top page, this is in Vayikra Rabbah. And in Vayikra Rabbah, they may or may not smell a rat. There seems to be a machloket about whether we should be smelling a rat or not among Tanayim. Amarav... Oh, I'm sorry, you don't have enough...
It's really not. You can have your very
own. Yeah. I printed out 7. This time there's exactly 7, so... Amar Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. This, by the way, is talking about an issue of Ola. It's brought on the Sukkim that talk about the Korban Ola, which is what used to be called the Holocaust before the 1940s when that was changed. Right? If you go to an old Bible and you take a look at the way the word Ola is translated, it was translated as a Holocaust. Because holocaust means it's completely burned up by fire. Holo, like holistic, which means completely, and cost as in fire. Caustic.
That would be the problem that you will bring because he's not Jewish. Later on,
that he brings holot. It's always holot. Yeah, that's true. And also that Jews bring under certain circumstances. And the Chazal actually say why that is, what was the olah geared for, and that's what the issue is going to be right here. I'm Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. La olam eina olah bala elo ahir ha'alev. The Ola was created specifically for sins of the heart. Only for sins that you commit in your heart. And immediately you should be saying, wait a second, Judaism doesn't believe in thought crime. So that we're going to explore exactly just that issue. Amar Rav Levi, Mikra Malehu. I can not only prove that that's true, I could prove it from a whole pasuk in Yechezkel. V'ha'ole al ruchachem. That which goes into your spirit, which means your thoughts that have entered your thoughts, although the play is on the word ha'oleh, hayu lo tihiyeh, they will not come to be, asher atem romim, that which you plan. The pasuk is talking about a case where the people say, listen, we've been thrown into exile, we've had enough of God, we're going to toss things down, we're going to pick up avoda zara. But they're playing on the words of ha'oleh al ruchachem, which means that the things that are in your heart, that's what you'd have to bring in oleh for. Mimi atalamed, and who could you learn this issue of the fact that an oleh is specifically for sins of the heart? Mibanav shel Iov, from the kids of Iov. Shenep betchilaf, because it says in the beginning, Balchu banav asu mishteh, they were the kids when they made a party. So now we have a machloket tanaim. Ravi Meir Omer, Shekein derech bnei malachim, liyot korim l'achihem v'lachiyotam imahem besuda. The reason why they invited the sisters, you see, it's bothering him. The reason why they're inviting the sisters is because kings used to invite their sisters. These guys were the power players. They were the richest people in town. Don't be shocked that the girls were being invited. That's just what they did. They boys invited the girls, their sisters, to the party. That was a king's way of doing it. Rav Tamchum Bar Chia Amar, Lihitapel Bahem, to get married. Lihitapel means to deal with them. But in this case, it means, I believe, to get them hitched. Halchu, so the hitapel behem halchu, they went to get them hitched. Shekitchu lahem nashim. The whole goal was to marry wives. But not clear at all what Rav Tamchum is saying. Exactly who was marrying who? What? Apparently, that was the goal. The goal was to shidduch for the sisters. That's the way it seems.
Or for themselves.
Or for themselves, correct. That's correct. A little unclear what it means, though. Hahadamar.
Well, maybe that connection is with the
Kaddish. Well, that's exactly right. Yeah, we'll get to that just in a second. It's exactly right. Hahadamar, and that's exactly what it says. Vayihi ki hikifo yumea mishteh. When the days of the party were finished, vayishlachi yov vayikadashen. Al date the Rabbi Tanchum Bar Chiya, according to Rabbi Tanchum Bar Chiya, who said that the whole party was for marriage, de amar shekidshu lahem nashim nitbalu bahem v'halchu. He came there to essentially get them married. He was the Masader Kedushin, so to speak. And as soon as he was finished, he would leave. Maybe it was that's a little bit of a difficult pshat, because the pshat is that this is happening all the time. Kacha yaseh kol hayamim. What happens after they finish getting married? Well, of course, the boys could keep on getting married over and over again. Aldate Rav Meir, but what about Rav Meir? Rav Meir, I understand Rav Meir's point that you invite the girls because that's the way kings invited the girls. They invited their sisters. But then what does it mean by Yikad Shem? Dehu Amar, Shekein Derech B'nei Malachim, Lihi Yod Korim Lachotem Lachotem Besuda. So what am I going to do with the second half of the Pasuk, which says that Eov went and he was Mekadesh them? Kedad Amar, like that which it says. Ve'el Ha'am Tomar, Hitkadashu, to the nation you shall say, become holy. Now the first thing that might jump into your mind, of course, is Matan Torah, right? Remember before Matan Torah, there had to be Shloshet Nei Hagbola, that they had to be Kodesh from Matan Torah. But that's not where the Pasuk is from. The Pasuk is from Bamidbar Yudalef, which I think is very significant that Chazal are quoting this. Why? Let's take a look in Bamidbar Yudalef, the second paragraph. This is the Kivrot Atava. No, it's Kivrot Atava. This is where they're all demanding meat. I want meat. I want more meat. It's not like Eretz. It's not like Egypt. We want meat. We want meat. The whole trouble's there. And Moshe couldn't handle it. He had to get 70. He had to essentially create a Sanhedrin of prophets to be able to handle the people. The Ela'am Amar, he kadshu l'machar, become holy for tomorrow. See, it's difficult not only in Eov, it's difficult here. Right? Everybody ever think of that? In Kivrot Atava, what was Moshe telling them? What does it mean, he kadshu l'machar? All you're going to find out is tomorrow you're going to eat meat. What do you have to be Kodesh to eat meat for? Hitkatshul machar v'achaltem v'achaltem basar. And eat meat, ki bachitem bo'oznei Hashem, because you cried in the ears of God. Le'mor mi achilenu basar, ki tov lanu mitzrayim v'natan Hashem lachem basar v'achaltem. You said you want to go back to Mitzrayim, God will give you the meat, you'll eat, and of course you all know what happened to the story. It was called Kivrot HaTavah, the meat was still in the teeth, and they all croaked. Again, the word hitkatshu is very difficult, so the Mepharshim come down on it. What do they say? Rashi says, v'hitkadashu. His minu atzvechem lepura nut. Get ready for troubles. Get ready for troubles. It could be. In fact, yeah, exactly right. Or prepare yourself to receive punishment for the sins that you did. In this case, he's not getting a punishment. He's countering the punishment with the ola. Exactly right. He's countering it. But he suspects them, in fact, of committing sins. According to this parish, he's quite sure they did sins, and the word lehit kadesh means I want you to be ready for puranut, the way, again, that quoting from the psukim of comparing them to kibrot ha'tava. That's where Rashi goes. Based on unkelis, by the way, the word lehit kadesh means lahazmin, to be mezuman, like if you're makdi shamtik tashem, you are setting it aside for God. Ibn Ezra, however, takes a slightly more balanced approach. What does he say? Hikadshu nimtza l'shevach ulignai. Sometimes hikadshu is positive, sometimes it's negative. And that's not much of an answer here, because if you want to know what Ibn Ezra felt about this one, he doesn't tell you. He says sometimes it's positive, sometimes negative. Mistama, he means that here it's negative, but it's not always negative. So, and by the way, that's very much true by the word of the whole idea of Kodesh. And it's an important idea, by the way, that probably bears a little exploring. The idea of Kodesh and the idea of Chayrim. I know normally we think of Chayrim as communication, but that's not what it means. Lahachrima means to destroy them. If you take a look at the Ir Nidachat, it says, V'yasu kol ha'ir chayrem, you shall make the whole ear chayrem. That means you're going to kill all the people in the city. Just in two words, something in two minutes, just to describe something which needs weeks and weeks to discuss. The idea of Kodesh and Kedusha and chayrem is something which has no physical representation on this world. When I'm makdi something to Hashem, I'm essentially saying, I know it's physical, but I'm removing it from it all physicality. I give it completely to God. The idea of Shabbat Kodesh, right? If you think about what is Shabbat Kodesh, the idea of where there is no physical presence at all. That is, there really is nothing. It's the idea that we remove all work, the idea we remove creativity, remove ourselves from this world. which is why, of course, the avoda was still done, of course, in the Beit HaMikdash. But the Beit HaMikdash was not, right? In the Beit HaMikdash, all 39 melachot were done with leisure and pleasure on Shabbat. It's those works that you can't do outside the Beit HaMikdash. Because the Beit HaMikdash is supposed to be a little bit of Olam Haba. It's supposed to be the next world. It's supposed to be something which is physically removed, like the Kodesh Kodashim, or on the way to Kodesh Kodashim. The word chayram also exists that way. When you put something to chayram, it means you destroy it, but also it's become defiled, and therefore it has no place on this world anymore, and therefore I must burn it up and destroy it and give it back to God, send it back to its maker. You will find the word kodesh used in negative senses in Tanakh, although rarely. You'll also find the word chayram used in positive senses. That is, the words are occasionally interchanged, but generally speaking, you think of the word chayram as the evil twin brother of kodesh. Kodesh is something I remove from the world in a positive sense. I give to God in a positive sense. Chayram is something I give to the world in a negative sense. So here we have a problem. What is he being mekadesh them? There's also, by the way, the simple pshat. He's going to bring korbanot. He's bringing korbanot from them. Mistama, they have to come along with him. So the simplest meaning of the word mekadesh is, listen, I have no idea whether you committed sins or not. I really have no clue. Just in case, however, I'm mekadesh you, so you can come with me and be mekadesh, and you can bring korbanot. The negative sense of mekadesh, which is you've definitely done a sin and you have to be ready for the punishment. In this case, we'll alleviate the punishment with the olah. And the more positive, ayikad shame, they were doing a nice thing, they're trying to get married, and Eov was trying to help them to get married. So here you have the, like this, the three senses of what might be going on, and it's still not definitive in my mind what exactly the sin is. Yeah, kol chayim konam. That is things that I say I'm not allowed to touch or use. So, for instance, hadavar zeh lai chayim means I'm not allowed to touch it, use it. It's essentially non-existent for me. Yes, it has no. Better would be it has no physical representation.
So it's like difference between neder and chayim would be.
A neder you actually would include things, and a chayim you tend to exclude. You exclude things from use. I also, I don't know if anybody has ever read Wrinkle, my best explanation for Chayram that I like to certainly give in my classrooms, although not everybody's read. Anybody ever read Wrinkle in Time? Do you remember that at the end of Wrinkle in Time, towards... No, it's Madeline L'Engle about this very wise boy, special boy named Charles, who goes with his sister Meg, and they travel into the dark space, and there's this thing called the It, which is like this disembodied brain, and from that came all the science fiction movies. But it was... At one point, it was not a cliche. It's actually a beautiful science fiction book. She's a Christian philosopher, by the way, so there are certain levels of Christianity, of sort of Christian philosophy in it, but I think it's still a very wise book and a very able book. A brilliant book. I always have my kids read it as whenever possible, and it's not. There are occasional tones of Christian, but a lot less than Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is also, I think, a worthwhile book to read. So there's this part where... they go to this evil planet, this thing called the It, which is controlling everybody's minds. And they serve up to Meg, who's the heroine, and Charles, who's the hero and the super brain, and another character along named Calvin, food. And the kids are eating the food, and it tastes like turkey, and it's all great, but Charles, who's sort of a super genius, won't eat any of it. He said, "Why don't you eat? We're all hungry." He said, "Because it tastes like dirt." So what turns out is there's not food at all. It's sand that they're eating. But the other one, Charles is wise enough to know, or intelligent enough to know, that it's all an illusion. It's a mind game. That is, it really has no physical entity. You can look at it, you can smell it, you can taste it, but really there's nothing there. I very often use that idea when it comes to chayram and even kodesh, although chayram in a negative sense and kodesh in a good sense. You may be able to see it, you may be able to smell it, but it really has no physical representation. It's an illusion. It really belongs wholly to God, and there's nothing left but ashes. That gets into halachic issues, by the way, of whether you could use a lulav from an ir nidachat, right? Whether you're allowed to use a lulav from a city which has been declared as an idol worshiping city. You're supposed to burn everything in, including the trees. What if you haven't burned it? Are you allowed to be using a lulav from an issue of thing? There's an issue of mitzvah ba me'avera, but there's an opinion in Tosha that brings down. It essentially says it's not that you can't use it because the mitzvah ba me'avera. I go back many years, so I'm not sure I'm quoting it right, so take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. What he's saying is, essentially, because it has to be burnt, it has no shear. It has no property. It has no number. It has no physical entity. That is, a lulav has to have a certain size. it has no size. You may be holding your hand, but since it's destined to be burnt, it's actually a bunch of ashes, and therefore a mitzvah, it's impossible to do a mitzvah with it. You can lift it and shake it as much as you want, but it's again Charles's ashes, not a real turkey. And I think that may be a good way of sort of picturing the idea of cheirem in this world. That if you might like it, you may not like it. I'm not sure it's the best way to describe it, but it's one of the best working definitions that I've found. What's interesting, though, based on all of this, is let's go back to the idea of sin. If there is a sin, and certainly there is an opinion that there is a sin, hence the Korban Ola, and since the idea of Mekadesh them, because he has to purify them for whatever they've done, we still have no representation of a physical sin. Chazal seems to be saying that it's only a Hir Hursha B'Lev. And what's interesting is, based on, generally speaking, our knowledge of Judaism, you don't get punished for thought crimes. Thought crimes is a rather Christian idea. I remember there's a funny anti...
Yeah, maybe he's a Christian.
What's that?
Oh,
right, that's true. First of all, the book is being sold to Goyim, but there's still an element of... You sort of jumped to my answer. I wanted to sort of set up with a question, and then I'll jump to the answer as well, although I'm not entirely... I think there may be another answer in addition. When it comes to thought crimes, we generally think there's no such thing as thought crimes. The guy who always makes me laugh, even though he's really an anti-Semite, and sometimes he lets slip, but I can't help think he's funny, is George Carlin. I don't know if you're familiar with the comedian. Mm-hmm. George Carlin. Yeah. Oh yeah, he says some pretty... I've seen him a lot of shows, a lot of his tapes, and he occasionally lets it slip out. Nonetheless, he's a funny guy, and he has this really funny routine that says if you wake up, he makes fun of Christianity. The only thing that makes it more palatable is he makes fun of his own religion much more than he makes fun of Judaism, so it becomes kind of palatable in that sense. He's sort of an ecumenical hater, as opposed to specifically a Jewish hater. So he talks about the silliness of Christianity and the thought crime that he says, you know, if you in Christianity, if you wake up one morning and say, I want to go down to 42nd Street, and the time of 42nd Street was 42nd Street, said, if you want to go down to 42nd Street and commit a mortal sin, save yourself the gas money, you just did it. So that's a very funny line, and it really sums up a little bit of the absurdity of ideas of Christianity, that thought crime really does count, as opposed to in Judaism, where if I want to go to the Burger King across the street from me, and I walk in, and at the last minute, they close the door, and I haven't eaten tripe. I may not be the best person in the world, but I'm not sure that there's room for tshuva, actually. There's no room for explicit tshuva. I don't think I'd bring it. I certainly, if you want to talk about it, korbanot, I don't think that there would be an issue. What?
It would be Mara's. There are people there.
Why can't people think I'm going to use a telephone? Every telephone is broken. Why shouldn't we be down the Kavskot? Mara and I, is another interesting issue, so maybe one day I'll talk about it, but that's more of a logic issue than a philosophical Tanakh issue. So we tend to think of Hir Hursha B'Lev not being punishable. And yet, if we take a look at this next Medrash Tanhuma, and here I'm going to come back to the Akeda, because as I said before, it all circles around the Akeda. So it says, Zachar Advarim Eilu, Ayad Dvar Hashem El Avram. So this is, of course, the famous Akeda. Yilmedenu Rabbeinu Ha'ole Alma Ha'itaba. Why would there even be an Ola, right? Because Yitzhak was supposed to be an Ola. So why specifically an Ola? Why was he supposed to be a Holocaust, a complete burning? Rabbi Shmuel Omer al mitzvah ta'aseh v'al mitzvah lo ta'aseh. According to Rabbi Shmuel, it's both a positive and negative command. Rashum Bar Yochai Omai al hir Hursha B'Lev. Not true. He sticks to his guns. Olda is only for thought crime. Shenamar v'yahahi kifo yimei amishdeh. When I was finished with the days of the party, he quotes Iyo v'yishlach Iyo v'yikad Hashem. He had to make them holy, prepare them for the Ola, but in a sense, he turned them into Olots also. Here's the connection between Abram and his son sacrifice, and Eov and his kids. Ata matzo Avram haya maharher midat adin. So what was Abram guilty of? He's guilty of Hir Hursha B'Lev. What was he guilty of? So what he was guilty of was questioning God's justice. Mahaya omer, what did he say? How about this for a little tiny sin that Abram is getting mighty punished, a big punishment for? Amar Rabbeinu Levi, Kimendume Li, it appears to me, Shekibalti Schari Bolam Azeh, I've already received my reward in this world. Sha'azrani HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Malachi, remember those four kings I wiped out? I shouldn't have been able to wipe them out. God must have given me an extra wink my way, gave me a little special favor. V'hatzileni b'kivshan ha'esh, and he also pulled me out of the fire of the famous fire. And therefore, Avram is worried that he's used up all of his bonus points in this world. He won't have a place in the world to come. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kevon shehir harta acharai, how dare you have thoughts about my way that I do business. By the way, this sounds, of course, just like Eov, right? Just like Eov. Kevon shehir harta acharai, ola atat tzarech lavi, you have to bring it ola. That is the whole Akedah Yitzchak is because Avram had a thought that maybe he got too much world reward in this world to come. Obviously, that's supposed to be understood at a homiletic level.
Right, but then they have to address the reason why Yitzchak had to be the one to be the Ola.
I'm going to get to that exact point, which is who pays the price for sins. It's exactly the point I'm going to end with. It's a very important issue. Right now, but you should be asked that question overall. Yitzchak is a blind character in the whole thing. He has no... whose test is it? We always say it's Avram's test. Rav Sprung said the following. Rav Sprung, in grappling with the issue, I think that his grapple is not correct grapple, but you can see Rav Sprung himself is grappling the issue. He said, why, I remember it was a few weeks ago in a drasha here, he said, why was it not a test for Yitzchak? Because he had Gvura, and therefore Yitzchak was able to stand up against it. I don't agree with that. I agree with Rav Sprung that you have to grapple with the issue. What about Yitzchak? On the bottom line, it was Yitzchak's throat getting cut, not Yaakov. It was Yitzchak being burnt, not Avram. Whose test exactly is it? So the way that Rav Sprung grappled, and I'm sure he's quoting Chazal, and I'm sure he has what the smoke on, but he's saying essentially it wasn't that for Yitzchak because Yitzchak thought it was no big deal. He was a gibor, he could stand up to the whole thing. I think that's an oversimplified way of looking at it, but the question that you still have to, if we discard Rav Sprung's issue so quickly, then the answer that Rav Sprung gave, then the question is, then what about, why is it only test Avram? What about Yitzchak? He's the one paying the price, and that's exactly the issue I'm going to get to. Because it's an issue by Eov also. So what does it say? Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kevon shehir harta acharai, ola atat tzarich lavi. She'emar katna et bincha yitzitacha ve'aleta, etc., etc. Okay, let's skip the rest of it. And Ramban quotes it lahalacha, by the way. Rabban quotes it lahalacha, which is an old edge for Hiro Shibalei, which is very strange, and I'll tell you why. Let's read the source, second from the bottom, Talmud Bavli. And this will explain why Hiro Shibalei is an issue in this case. Talmud Bavli is...
My impression has been that the Ola represents a complete dedication of oneself to Hashem.
Okay.
And thus, and it's symbolized by the standing being vaporized.
That's correct.
Completely given over to Hashem.
That's
now, if that's the case, if you're dedicating your whole self to Hashem,
yeah,
then most of, you know, what's directing you in your efforts as you go through life is your lathe.
Is your what?
Your lathe.
Right.
And so, sins in which you are not
very nice,
behaving in a way that you are totally dedicated to
right
them, need to be redressed by resetting your attitude.
Yeah. In fact, that's exactly what the Ramban says, although a little sharper, just because with the word oleh, you talk about the word dedication. The word oleh is only used in Vayikra, the word chapara, to request forgiveness. And oleh specifically is not when you're dedicated, it's when you need to exchange some things for your... there's a sense of sin always by an oleh. I don't believe there's ever an oleh, and the dava is always a shlamim, always people. The only thing that you bring in oleh completely, where it's completely burnt up, is where there is a clear sin, because it's a vayichapera al nafsho. I can't find it now in Vayikra, but it's here somewhere. And the Ramban, so it's similar to what you're saying, the Ramban says, there's only you know, and God knows what's in your heart, then only a sacrifice which is totally burnt and not left over for you is something that can sort of redeem something which only is between you and God. Although from a more negative sense rather than a positive sense.
A sin of the heart.
Well, that's what I'm going to get to with this. The question is, does Judaism make you responsible for the sins of the heart? Where is it called in Judaism?
Yeah.
So here I want to read you a fascinating Gemara. Part of a fascinating Gemara. It's fascinating for 1,000 reasons. I'm going to read just one part of it, and you'll want to ask 100 questions, and I just, you know, I won't have time for it here, but it's a fascinating Gemara. Hi, Mani. Who is this Tana? We're arguing about whether there's reward in this world or only in the world to come. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yaakov, he. The Amar Schar Mitzvah Bahai Al Maleka. A person never gets any reward in this world. I'm sure you've heard that. This famous Machloket Schai. Chai mitzvah b'hai alma ika or leka, whether we do have reward in this world or not. And of course, a philosophical issue, and people always take stands on what they believe. Ditanya, Rav Yakumar, ein lecha kol mitzvah or mitzvah, shkutuvah b'torah, you never have a single mitzvah, shematan tzchara b'tzidah, that it says you're going to get a reward, she'ein tchiyat ha-meitim tchiyim ba. What it means, you're not going to get a reward in this world, you're going to get a reward in the next world. Kivra ve'ein k'tiv, it says by your honoring your mother and father, l'man yarichud yamecha u'l'man yitav lach, it'll make your days long. That seems to be a reward in the world, this world. L'man yitav lach means in this world. V'shiluach haken k'tiv, l'man yitav lach b'harach v'yanim, same thing about chasing away the bird from the mother, and you will get long life and you will get good days. Hari sha'am, so essentially what he can explain is that means good long days in the world to come, and goodness in the world to come. So he says, Hari Sha'amr Lo Aviv. I have a story for you, Rabbi Yaakov wants to tell. There was a guy whose father told this boy, Allah Labira, go up to the capital city, Vahagali Gozalov, and bring me some chickadees. I'm hungry. Bring me some chickadees. Va'Allah Labira, and he listens to his father, he goes up to the capital city, V'Shalach Et Ha'en, chases away the mother, V'Natal Et Banim, he takes the kids, while he's on the way down, not fault of me. He dies and he croaks and dies. It's a famous Gemara. Famous Gemara. Heichan Tovat Yimav Shalzeh. So if Yaakov says, so tell me where this guy's good days were. You're telling me he did the two mitzvahs, but somebody says you have long days and good life. Guy goes up, he does both of them in one shot, and he croaks on the way back. So where's his good life? And of course, the Gemara is grappling with the same issues, by the way, that Eov is grappling with, which is Tov Viralo. Somebody is good and evil happens to him. So the Gemara says, Heichan Arichot Yimav Shaleh, where's his long days? Se'ela Leman Yitov Lach, what does it mean that you can have goodness? La'olam Shekulo Tov, in the world that is totally good, which means Olam Abba. Leman Yarichun Yamecha, La'olam Shekulo Aroch, in the days that are completely long, that is the eternal days. V'dil Malav Hachi Hava. So the Gemara says, maybe it's a totally made up story. Wow. Rav Yaakov is making this whole moral case about this guy who goes up and his father tells him he's got to do this and that, he croaks on the way down. How do I know it really happened? Maybe Rav Yaakov's just making it up.
Making a hypothetical
case. But how can you prove anything from a hypothetical case? So Rav Yaakov Masa Chazek. No, it doesn't. Rav Yaakov said he saw it specifically with his eyes. It wasn't a parable. V'dilma maharher b'aveirahaya. How do I know that while the guy wasn't going up to get the thing, he wasn't saying, my stinking father, he's the worst guy, he made me go all the way for a bunch of chickadees, I could have bought them in the next door. Machshevet ra'a, ain't a Kadosh Baruch Hu mitzarefet l'maseh. Thought crimes do not get attached to physical crimes. So here the Gemara seems to come out explicitly against the idea of thought crimes in Judaism. V'dilma, but the Gemara counts like this, V'dilma maharher b'avoda kochavim. But maybe his thought crimes were specifically about a bodhisattva. Now you have the crux of it. There is really one thought crime in Judaism. That thought crime is a bodhisattva of things revolving around a bodhisattva. Because if you think about it, the only one of the Ten Commandments, which is a thought commandment, is really what? Right, but how about the other one? Is an Anokhi Asher Elokecha. What does that mean? The thought. It's a thought. Just like there's a thought, if it makes sense, just like there's a thought mitzvah, which is to love and recognize God, if you think that that's a mitzvah, it's a machlok rishonim on whether that's really a mitzvah or just a statement. But if you assume that that's the mitzvah that you have to do, the simple recognition in your heart, then obviously to counter that, for every yin-yang situation which exists in Judaism also, there must be an equal and opposite thought crime, which is avodah zara. And that then makes sense with Eov, because Eov is not worried that they thought about their sisters in the wrong way. He's not worried that they partied the wrong way or they drank wine that they were supposed to drink. He says specifically, Uverhu Elohim Bil Lavam. What was their thought crime? That they cursed God. And the Rambam brings that down to Halacha. We're running a little short on time. The Rambam brings that down to Halacha. Specifically, he says that when it comes to Megadeth, one who curses God, that would be even Beliba. Even a sin. It's a sin even if you would curse God in your heart. Even if you curse God in your heart. This is a big philosophical decision that I'm giving very short shrift to. Not everybody has the same opinions. There's much machloket on it. I just want to give you one possible opinion that fits into Eov very nicely. So Eov is concerned that they committed a sin, but it was a sin specifically of the heart. Why then, as I said before, is the Satan not test them for sins of the heart? I said before that as long as it doesn't come out in their mouth, if you take a look at verse 22, he didn't curse him with his mouth. And Chazal say, in fact, if you take a look at the end of chapter 2, verse 10, says Vatomer Hal Vat Yomer Elah. He tells his wife, Kadaber Achad and Avalom Kadaberi Gamad Zom Kabel Meir Talhim that the Rah Lord Kabel will take good from God, but we don't take bad. Bechol Zot Lachata Iyo Bisvata. He wouldn't curse God with his lips. The Chazal jump on this. They said not with his lips, but with his heart. But so what? He still wins the bet. He wins the bet. As long as he doesn't come out within the heart. So here I came across, I'm sorry, they don't have it. It's not on the shelf. It's an English Medrash Rabbah on Parsha Bereishit. And I don't have it in front of you, but I wish I did. It says specifically that the only, for all the sins that Adam created in Gan Eden, the only reason he was thrown out is because he was Megadeh Hashem. Because he cursed God for his lot, and that's why he got kicked out. It's a medrash, it's not what it actually is written in text, but he's trying to tell you that the sin, the ultimate only sin that really blocks you out completely, is the only, that it wasn't just having bad thoughts about what he wanted from God, it was specifically saying, I want to be like God. And here I want to show you something very interesting, and I'm going to get back to the issue about the kids and the punishment. If we take a look, I'd like you to go now to chapter 7, 8. I think, hold on. This is Bildad HaShuchi. This is the, it's nice that we're actually getting to the poetry part. It's so beautiful. And we'll certainly be finished in 5 minutes. Vayan Bildad HaShuchi Vayomar. Now we're skipping Eliphaz's speech because Eliphaz doesn't deal with this directly. Bildad, however, Eliphaz in the first does not accuse anything of Eov of sins at all. He accuses him of speaking appropriately and questioning God, but he accuses him of no sins. Bildad, not so. Let's take a look and see what sins Bildad accuses Eov of. Eov saying, "How come you punished me? I didn't do anything wrong." So Eliphaz says, you're right, you didn't do anything wrong, but you must know that the good things will happen to you in the end anyway. Have some faith. Not so Bildad. Bildad says, oh really? You're so holy? Let's take a look. Ad an timalel eila. Until how long are you going to speak like this? Which is, how dare you speak so against God that you've committed no sin? Veruch kabir imre ficha. And the words of, I think kabir is like a mighty one, but in a negative sense. Or that will come out of your mouth. The spirit of a mighty one comes out of your mouth. I think he's accusing him of egotism, of stepping beyond his bounds. Ha'el yaveit mishpat? You think that God will twist aside justice? You think that God, if he punished you, you don't think he's doing the right thing? God always does the right thing. If you're being punished, there's a reason you're being punished. Ve'im shaddai yaveit tzedek? You think he won't do tzedek and mishpat? He'll never do the wrong thing. Im banecha chatu lo. Do you see what this says? In verse 4, do you see that? Im banecha chatu lo, if your sons sinned against him, vayishalchem biyad kisham, he will send them out with his hand kisham, with their sins. He will take their sins, and with the sins he will cast them aside. So essentially, what does Bildad say? Listen, your sons died because they did sin. And what Bildad may be saying here, in a sense, is, what are you complaining about yourself for?
Not your issue.
You, what are you complaining? You're alive. Your kids got off because your kids did sins.
Yeah.
That's exactly what
it is. It's not exactly being rewarded.
Oh, I agree 100%. And by the way, take a look at Eov's response in verse 10. Yeah, I'm sorry, chapter 10. By Yan Eov Vayomar. Chapter 9, verse Paraket. Vayani Yov Yamar, Omnam Yadati Chichain. I know what you're saying is true. Umayitzdak Enoshimel. And how could a person ever come to be right in the eyes of God? That is, a person can't be more right than God. Oh, wait, no, that's not what I wanted. There's a part where he says, hold on. Hold on. He essentially says, if I committed a sin, then show me what it was. Prove it. He rejects, I'm sorry, I don't have it at my hand. He essentially rejects the idea that there's any sin whatsoever. I'm sorry, I thought it was right there. It's not. But it's soon. When we go through the poetry, we'll actually take a look at it. He's essentially saying, show me what I did wrong. Show me the beef. I can't find it. If I start to run for it, I definitely won't find it. I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't find it right now. Well, if there's no question that Bilbo Ashuki is accusing him of sins, if that were true, first of all, Eov says it's not true. Second of all, if Eov would agree with that, if that was true, then he would stop yapping. But he doesn't stop yapping. He goes on to complain and complain. If it's so simple as my sons got killed and therefore they die, then what's the problem? So that is why is Eov still complaining? So here I want to get back to your issue with the sons and the father and with Avram and Yitzhak. The truth is, I think it is not being brave to try to figure out why Yitzhak is being punished. That is, whenever you deal with something called, whenever you deal with punishment, there are two possibilities. There's collective sin, and there's collective sin and punishment. Sorry, there's collective punishment, and there's individual punishment. That is, I commit a sin, and a lot of people are punished. We have that type of thing in Melachim. Menashe is a terrible, terrible king, and all the people have to get exiled because of it. And Yechezkel seems to be speaking out against it. Yechezkel seems to be saying, Lo Yomar, one the day will come when people won't say, the fathers have committed sins and the sons are cracking their teeth on the punishment of the sons. It becomes a real issue during exile times. We did nothing wrong, and yet we're sitting here in exile. It's the idea of collective punishment. Individual punishment would be, I did a sin and I have to get tested for it, I have to get punished. But the truth is, it's not so simple. It's not so simple. And I'd like to prove it, just to read you a quick story with David HaMelech. David HaMelech, all the people get punished. At the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet, if you remember, there's a very interesting story. David does a census, right? And what happens to the people?
There's a plague,
right? And what does David actually say? David says like this, if you happen to have it, it's in Shmuel Bet. He has a choice of punishment,
yes.
That's correct. But something very... Correct, but there's something interesting when it comes to who's being punished and why. Let's take a look at this verse. Yeah, it's all a problem, there's no question. But let's
cost thousands and thousands of people, and David's the one being punished.
Exactly right, and David seems to question that himself. Listen to what David says. Vayosef af Adonai l'charop Yisrael, vayasid David b'hem l'mor, lech menei Yisrael that you die. He does a census. So there's a whole discussion. He's not supposed to do a census. He pushes Yoav to do the census. In Pasuk Hey, Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk Chet. Oh, by the way, Pasuk Chet, when Eov is going around to do the census, you know what word it uses in Shmuel? Vayashutu b'chol ha'aretz. You recognize the word Vayashut? Remember the Satan? Shati va'am. See, there's a connection there. There's Vayashutu. Vayavo v'ksei tishah chodashim v'shvim yom yishlayim v'yitin yoav v'ksei tishah to do the census. Vayach leiv David otah v'rechen v'far ha'am v'yomer David ol Hashem chatati ma'od asher asiti v'atah Hashem ha'vir na'at avon ha'pecha v'neskalta ma'od. So he's sorry he does tshuva. Udvar Hashem ayal gan anavi. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a second. Vayitein yoev emesparam el melech vati Yisrael. Oh, wait. Hold on. You know, I should have looked up these sources, but now I'm a little bit weak on it. Oh, yeah. He asks for a magifa. Right? He asks for a magifa on the people, and God chooses the magifa. Now what happens? Vayomer David al Gad, Sar Limo, Diflana Biyad Hashem, Ki Rabbi Rachamav, Viyad Adam al Kulab. Vayitin Hashem Dever Bi Yisrael, Vayaboker Vayet Moed, Vayamat Ami Dan Vayaber Sheva, 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 Vayaber Sheva, Shivim Elafi. 70,000 people die in the plague. It's pretty big for one sin, right? Vayishlach David Malach Yushlaim Lashachata, Vayishlach Yado Amalach Yushlaim Lashachata, Vayinach Hashem Rav, Vayomer Lamalach Hashvi, Vayam Rav Taher Yadecho, Malach Hashem Ayad Gorida, Vayna Yusiv, Vayomer David Hashem, Beroto Malach, Amakeh, Vayam, when he sees the angel killing the people, Vayomer Hinea Nochi Chatati, I sinned, Vanochi Heaviti, I'm the one who committed the crime, Ve'il Hatzon, but these sheep, means the rest of the people of Israel, Nasu, what did they do? Why are you punishing them? Dihina Yadcha Bi Ubivait, so here he says something very interesting. He says the people don't deserve to be punished. That's collective punishment. It's not fair. But when he says that the sin should be, what does he say? Tinayatcha bi ubeveit avi. What does beit avi mean? My father's house, which means his family. You see that? That is, when David rejects the idea of collective punishment, he does not reject the idea of family punishment. Because ultimately, family punishment is collective. It is individual punishment. When a father does something bad and the kids pay the price, well, look, you know, that's a basic sense. You know, somebody takes, you know, that's something which biologists could tell you from here. You know, somebody does bad things during pregnancy, the child pays the price. There is consequence to be done. Kids do get sacrificed for the sins of their fathers, and it's not the kid's fault. And it's not the kid's test, even though they have to go through the price. And that, I think, is visible from the words here. That is, if you're a king, by the way, and I think it extends, if you're a king, then your people are actually responsible. And then David says, listen, don't do it. It's not fair. It's not right. Even though I'm the king, limited to my household. And God seems to go along with that ideal by the fact that he wants to contract the sin. But even there, I'm not sure it's collective punishment. If a king is responsible for his people, if a king does a sin, then the people pay the price. And that's a pretty basic idea. If a king leads people to a stupid war, then people die. And if a person does something bad, then the kids pay the price. Which means Eov never takes his eye off the ball. Eov is not for a minute suspicious that his kids did a sin. He's sure that they didn't. And if they did do a sin, it was belayed. That's not something you get punished for, especially when you bring in a lot. So when Bildad HaShuhi comes and says, maybe it was your kid's fault, he rejects that out of hand. I didn't commit a sin. My kids didn't commit a sin. But when you're reading Eov, and by the way, Akedah Yitzchak, it's not Yitzchak's punishment because Yitzchak is a consequence. That's like Chas V'Shalom, if a person leaves all the windows in his, I'll mention Eric Clapton as opposed to somebody more snippet. Eric Clapton lost the baby because he left the windows open and his baby crawled out the window and fell, right? That's a sin of the father. I don't want to accuse Eric, I'm not Hashem, I want to clearly accuse Eric Clapton of the sin. That's a sin of the father where the child pays the price. Nobody thinks that a two-year-old who crawled out an open window 10 stories up committed a sin. So there's an idea where I think we've sort of overdone the idea of individual punishments. We think individual punishment only individually, and therefore we struggle with the idea of Yitzchak, his test. Yitzchak didn't have a test. He was going to be killed because of his father's actions. And this is an acceptable idea in Judaism, and it's an acceptable idea with Eov. Eov is not upset that the kids are being punished for his sin. He didn't do anything wrong. He did nothing wrong. And that's why he's not accepting the idea. Which means ultimately, I went over time anyway. What I've really done is I said, let's recap. I said we're looking for a sin in the kids. And the kids did a sin, then maybe there's a whole issue with punishment. But as Eov said, he's not interested in the kids' sins. And anyway, he did tshuva for the kids. He did an olo, which we saw as acceptable for a year or. And that's all he was worried about. There's no sense that it was anything else. And everybody says that they're only all the chazal, simply said it was hirhor. Even if there was anything, it was just hirhor. The sins of the kids are not in play here. Because the punishment of the kids is not in play here. It's a story about Eov. Then a question is, what's the whole story with the brothers and sisters? Again, why bring the brothers and the sisters involved if there's no sin? I mean, if there is here, it only applies to the brothers. So here I'm going to say something which is just a more of a scholarly approach to the book, but I think it bears paying attention to. It's something that Nachum Sarnak calls the epic substratum in the book of Job. What that means is Eov was meant to be read in a play format. Its meaning was audience. He actually compares this to Greek myths where you have the god with 7 sons and 3 daughters, and only the daughters have names, just like in Eov. And you have the thing about the 10 kids and the 10,000 sheep, and then it repeats stuff. And it was at the day when he came, and just before the first guy finished speaking, the second guy ran in. What you could picture, and I believe what you should be picturing, say, for Eov, is a play, right? The first guy comes, you're going to go, Eov, fire, go, 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 and then just when he finished speaking, the second guy runs on the stage, Eov, heaven, and the third guy runs on the stage. It's very poetical. And he actually cites ancient Greek and Ugaritic literature to prove that this very, very is repetition of words. It was on that day. Remember, the Satan repeats itself. Do you know that there's nobody in the world like my thing? And the Satan goes, oh, really? Is that really true? And then Hashem says, oh, yeah, you can do this, you can do that. This repeated. The storylines are repeated over and over again. The idea of the 7 sons, the 3 daughters, the 7,000 sheep, the 3,000. It's a play format. And the audience of the book, and this is a very mundane answer, but I think it has value. The audience of the book is ultimately the broad world. We already spoke about that. Whether the author wanted to sell his book to everybody, or whether, as a philosophy, whether he actually wanted to be able to sell the book to everybody, or both, is the fact that Hashem's name doesn't appear essentially anywhere in the prose. Because the book is meant to be not just about what happened to Jews, what happens about people in the greater world. It's written in the exile, and they're dealing with the world around them, and the Jews are no longer insulated, and how are people going to deal with this idea of God? And therefore, I believe that it was written in the format of literature at that time, that if they wanted to write these big, fantastic stories that people would believe in. And I don't know if that makes it any less Kodesh. If you're not comfortable with that idea, then we can go back to the idea of maybe they didn't hear, or you can play with ideas. But ultimately, it's a play. Eov is a play. It's a drama. And we're trying to make it as dramatic as possible. And it happens to be the literature at that time really played up the seven brothers and the three sisters. It exists in literature at the time. It's written in Greek literature. It's written in Hebrew literature. And that's the way things were done. So ultimately, we could look for sin here, but then we struggle to find out what the sin is. And certainly that's possible, and Chazal are doing it. Or we could say, this is the way the books were written at that time, where they were written in this format. And it's a mundane answer, but I think it certainly bears thinking about. And that's, again, I went over time, so I apologize. And that's the shear. Yeah.